Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Chuck Thurston, Andre Rodatis, and Marvin Garin. Hi, you guys.
We're all here.
Good morning.
Yay. Marvin, welcome.
Good morning,
Andre. Good to have you back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we are we're heading into the busy holiday season, and we'll be off a couple of times just during this season, probably. And but we'll try to be on most of the time. Not sure. We're still deciding if we want to do Saturday after Thanksgiving, et cetera. But we'll let you guys know in plenty of time, so you can make your plans too. We always appreciate you being here with us, listening. Thanks to all of our listeners on the archive and live on the board. We sure appreciate you. And so you guys are ready for this busy season, I'm sure. I know Marvin and Andre have a UUI board meeting coming up next weekend, so they won't be here. And we're talking about, well, maybe we can take the day off, or maybe we can have a special episode. So keep posted, and we'll let you know what happens. But today we are still on paper 37, Personalities of the Local Universe, Urantia paper 37, that is. And we're going to be covering section 6 today, the Celestial Overseers, or just Celestial Overseers. I added the so this will be another great study. And we had a great week last week studying the High Commissioners. Did you guys have any thoughts on what we've studied so far, that things that you want to share? Am I?
I think it's – yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead,
Chuck.
Well, that thing came up about spirit-fused mortals. Spirit fusers,
right.
Spirit fused ascenders, and I'm trying to refresh my memory. I know they came up in the High Commissioners section,
Yeah, right at the beginning.
Yeah. We'll talk about how these souls, these surviving souls of this order attain immortality by eternal fusion with an individualized fragment of the spirit of the local universe, Mother Spirit. I mean, that alone is a pretty interesting statement. And in another place, in paper 40, in section 9, they also talk about, spirit fusers there as well. And here they say that ascending spirit-fused mortals are not third source personalities. They are included in the Father's personality circuit, but they have fused with individualizations of the pre-mind spirit of the third source and center. So yeah, that, you know, I want to kind of put an equal sign somewhere in there, you know, this individualized fragment of the spirit of the local universe, Mother Spirit, must in some sense also be an individualization. That individualized fragment must in some sense be an individualization of the pre-mind spirit of the third source and center. I just think that's really interesting. You know, thinking about thought adjusters being not only pre-personal, but pre-everything, essentially, given that they're fragments of the, you know, the original first source and center. So this, the pre-idea gets involved in both of these types of fusion. But the, I don't know. I just wonder if you have any thoughts about that. I mean, we know that the Mother Spirit is herself an individualization of the Infinite Spirit. You know, and her individuality emerges over time. And
well, you know,
the circumstances.
They're trying to educate us, right? This is this is brand new. It's brand new. We've never had a revelation that was not a personal revelation. That is, so even if it was during an epical period, where unless somebody was extremely advanced, they were giving the general facts and truth of us being Marantia beings, of us having a soul that grows in the Marantia, that is incepted by the thought adjuster, and that has a life that is somehow this combined spirit material life, this intervening life that allows us to bridge successively greater and greater spiritual development, spiritual levels, 570 of them. And there has to be a way to do that. There has to be a method. There has to be a mechanism or a dynamism, if you prefer. It's a little of both. And there has to be support for all of that. So we're told about all of that support. The thing that now is being differentiated and that they're trying to underscore for us is they've already taught us something about these father personalities and spirit personalities, and they don't want us to confuse it. Now that we're being told about spirit-fused beings, they want to go ahead and disabuse us of the idea of conflating a spirit-fused being with, you know, spirit-bestowed personality.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry?
Yeah, third-source personality.
Yeah, third-source personality, yeah. That's the better term for it. Thank you. So the idea being then, that okay, so they're telling us, well, they start out just like you. In fact, their personality is of your order. There's no difference personally, but the difference becomes after this life, when in order to bridge them over to the next life, there's no way that they would have been able to fuse with a thought adjuster. Either they were of the lone order, or they are of that attenuated type of mortal that is more of a radical adjustment, with whether like a non-breather or some other radical adjustments, or primitive mortals is the largest category. that in some cases, they're so primitive that they never, you can imagine what kind of a soul, even if they have a thought adjuster bestowed on them, some of them may not be able to evolve a soul that is very robust. I mean, that's a characterization, and it's an opinion. But but you can speculate as to why that might be, but they still are worthy of survival. They were given personality. They have had actually a very unique and unusual experience as a primitive being on a world of space, which must have some kind of intrinsic value. And so long as they have the you know, least little flicker of faith that they understand themselves to be super animal, that they understand that there is something greater than themselves, they are worthy of survival. And so the mechanism for that, or the dynamism for that, is to bestow a spirit pre-mind fragment on that and on them. And they want to make sure that we understand that clearly, and that this is a major way that mortals go ahead. We're not only told, you know, that it happens in this local universe, but elsewhere. And I always have trouble finding this particular passage, but that there's the passage that differentiates creator sons and how they set up their local universes. In ours, it's barely 10% are spirit fusers. Michael, in his wisdom, has decided that about 90% of the worlds are going to be adjuster fusion inhabited worlds. He is loving the idea of having more of us leave the local universe, leave the nest, so to speak, and join the core of the finality to be useful later in the outer space levels and have only 10% here. They contrast that with another local universe where almost 50%, they say, are spirit fusers. Now, that's a very different way to organize your local universe. You're keeping more of that wisdom for your local universe and to upstep it that way. And so that tells you, that's just giving you two data points along with a third data point that there are going to be 700,000 creator sons in 700,000 local universes, and each one of them is going to do it their own way. Is it possible that there's some creator son that has done more than 50%? It would be within their rights to do so, but maybe they indicated that as a general limit, and maybe there are local universes where it will go down even further than 10%. With even more with some of their creator sons, who knows? But the whole point being, there had to be a mechanism to move mortals along, and that mechanism is the pre-mind spirit. So then the next thing in learning about this and trying to glean that from what the book is teaching is to say, okay, they give us a lot about the thought adjuster and what the thought adjuster is doing for us in this life, and then after this life. So what is that spirit mind, pre-mind spirit doing? And it must, in the same way that the thought adjuster is allowing us to actually come to consciousness and to be able to think and live and have everything and actually carries our memory, aside from having memory, because there's no way for that pre-mind spirit to have it unless they decided that they were going to do uploads in that. And for whatever reason, they're not doing that. They're not doing a transfer of memory to a pre-mind spirit. They are, in fact, leaving that with the thought adjuster and having a fresh pre-mind spirit so that this mortal being actually starts out as though it was their first life. As far as their consciousness goes, their initial consciousness is such that, as far as they know, they have just woken up as a Marantxa being, and it appears to be their first life. Now, that's fascinating.
Wow.
It's fascinating to consider that and how important they are to the economy of a local universe. And so that's why they're telling us about these guys now.
They do recover their memories, though.
They do recover their memories eventually, yes. But the point is
they literally have a beginning
as though they're a fresh being. That's different.
I think the angels help out with that recovery process as well.
That is so interesting.
Imagine the difference in how you start out.
Another big difference too is that they fused upon awakening with this pre-mind spirit. In that paragraph in paper 40, section 9, they say such spirit fusion never occurs during the span of a natural life. It takes place only at the time of mortal reawakening in the Marantxa existence. So that's a big difference too, because most of us, are probably not going to fuse during this life, but we'll probably be somewhere along the way in the master worlds, typically, I think, when we achieve adjustment. We still have a lot more to do. In other words, adjuster fusion is an achievement.
Does that insinuate that they always fuse at that time?
That's what it sounds like, yeah.
Well,
it
implies that if there is a soul to go on, that soul going on is then fused, and they are ready to go forward. So presumably, a mortal that didn't want to go on, that had somehow made that choice in this life, that was destined to be a spirit fusion candidate, would simply not wake up in the next life, and that would be that. Now, that tests a lot of people's notions of survival, right? Because that's got to be a possibility.
Right.
Well, they point out that they grow a soul. I mean, they are a jester and dwelt during their mortal life, and that's when they have the opportunity to grow a soul, just like we do. But they don't fuse with that adjuster.
But that adjuster acts more as a guide to them.
And also a soul cultivator. I mean, you can't survive without a soul.
Right.
Is there any other place, Chuck, where they, or Andre or Paula, where where they indicate that the fusion occurs right upon reawakening? That's kind of interesting. I hadn't thought
that.
Yeah,
I thought
before.
So too. Well, this statement in paper 40, section 9, paragraph 1 seems pretty definitive. It says it takes place only at the time of mortal reawakening in the Marantxa.
Yeah,
and they don't say it takes place only in their Marantxa's career somewhere along the way. It takes place only at the time of mortal reawakening. So
There are a couple of other interesting things. One I hadn't caught before, that they have something. They have the equivalent of a finality core. They have a local universe core of perfection.
Core of perfection.
And
then the next paragraph, the Nebadon core of perfection. So that's interesting that they have a sort of final destiny status. The other thing that's interesting to me, we've talked about this before, you're talking about connecting data points, Andre. It is possible. There's a relatively small number, especially in this local universe, you say 10%, that are spirit-fused of the ascenders. but it is possible that somewhere along the way as we ascend, because we're adjuster-fused, and we have experienced adjusters on this world, which means they've had a previous indwelling as a virgin adjuster, and many of them will have had a previous indwelling in a spirit, a mortal that's destined to be spirit-fused, because that's a common mm-hmm. way they get that initial experience, that there's a real possibility that we will encounter another ascender, a spirit-fused ascender, who we've shared an adjuster with.
Wow.
Wow, that's
which
that's
is pretty
awesome.
Astounding, because that adjuster
that
would have the full memory of that spirit ascender, and so that would be a very intimate kind of kinship,
wow,
sibling relationship, because of that shared adjuster, I would imagine.
There could be more than that.
They certainly don't say that, but the implication is there, and so that seems like that must happen. That's pretty intriguing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
especially since we're all ascending in the same universe, you know.
Yeah,
I would think it's possible for sure. It's like twins separated at birth.
It's highly, it's going to be a rare kind of a thing for somebody to meet up with a being that has their thought adjuster.
Because they
indicate that those thought adjusters are essentially they diversify. It seems to be their MO that they don't even come to the same super universe serially. Generally, they'll go to other super universes to get other kinds of experiences.
Yeah, right.
They want to get a very, for lack of a better term, excuse the pun, a universal experience. You know, a grand universal experience, that one that is encompassing as whatever it is that they've achieved so far. They're looking for something that will complement that, and they keep making those kinds of choices, because after all, the only kind of differentiating choice that a thought adjuster can make in terms of who they select is somebody that they can use the experience that they hold. It's the experience that they hold that differentiates them, nothing else. Otherwise, they're all divinely perfect. There's no difference in any other way between virgin adjusters. So it's their choices after virgin being virgin adjusters is to select a candidate that can use their experience best. Which has to be an amazing selection process.
Oh, without a doubt.
By the way, I wanted
but
to
I,
say...
But I have a... I, go ahead, Andre.
Well, I just wanted to quickly say I know why I said seraphic core of completion. It's because that's a synonym for this. They do talk about the Nebadon core of perfection here in this paper, but in paper 40, they state 40.10.6, they say... finaliters acquire a marvelous and far-flung experience of transient service in all seven segments of the grand universe, but they do not ordinarily acquire that intimate knowledge of any one universe which now characterizes the spirit-fused veterans of the Nebadon core of completion. So they have two ways of referring to it, the Nebadon core of perfection, the Nebadon core of completion. They're trying to give us a sense of two different aspects.
That was
40.
That was 40.
40.10.6.
Great, thanks.
Well, so can somebody briefly define what pre-mind means? I mean, we get pre-personality, right? The thought adjuster.
Yeah.
What does pre-mind mean? I think of the spirit as mind. You know, her gift is mind. But then again, the father's gift is personality. So is it similar to what we acquire? The father gives us identity and we give him personality. the spirit then would give these candidates mind, or they would give, you know, how would that work? Would they give her mind?
Well, it would be a way of giving identity as well, because identity comes from consciousness. And, I mean, that's part of where it's coming from anyway. I mean, when the adjuster is returning with that identity, what is the signal experience that incepts us, you know, consciousness?
Right.
Well, the thing that makes us realize we're alive is bang.
We're
conscious again.
Right.
Yeah. And that has to be one of the main purposes. So the question is, if it's not carrying aspects of who we were previously, as the thought adjuster is, the nature of the pre-mind spirit, is there any differentiation? They're not revealing anything about that pre-mind spirit. Is it the same spirit? Is it like a virgin adjuster, only it's a virgin pre-mind spirit? Or does the spirit take note? I mean, we've grown up in that spirit. We've grown up, if we've had a thought adjuster, with some encirclement into the Holy Spirit, so that Mother Spirit is fully aware of who we are. Is there some response to us that is individual, or is that response to us the same as it is for any spirit-fused ascender with exactly the same kind of spirit? It's an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Chuck, then I'll go.
Okay, yeah, just sort of quick. Yeah, if you look at those two paragraphs together again, I think also part of what they're saying is that spirit is prior to mind.
Yeah.
And in 37, they say that they fuse with an eternal fusion with an individualized fragment of the spirit of the local universe, Mother Spirit. So that's pretty clear that this is a spirit endowment. And
mm-hmm.
then in that other reference, they say fused with an individualization of the pre-mind spirit of the third source and center. So there's recognition that, yeah, she does bestow mind, but she has a spirit nature, you know, that comes from the infinite spirit that is prior
pre-mind.
To mind.
Yeah.
Right. It's prior to mind, I think is what they're saying there. So that individualized
mm-hmm.
fragment of the spirit. But that's an interesting point, though, Andre, you reckon there at the end, because these are only fused once. In other words, these spirit and spirit fragments do not have prior experience the way adjusters do.
Yeah, they're virgin.
Because
they've never been used.
They fuse it's sort of almost automatically, it seems, at the time of reawakening. So they're never going to split off from that ascender, I don't think, after that.
No.
I mean, they don't say that specifically, but that seems to be the implication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just back to your question, Paula, what are they meaning by pre-mind? I mean, one implication that flows from the use of pre-personal is that whenever a pre-personal being is in association with a personal being, the personal personality function has primacy, and the pre-personal being stands in abeyance, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and allows the personal being's will to manifest. So maybe there's a parallel distinction in the pre-mind, you know, that with a spirit-fused being, the mind of that being has primary function, which is, you would think that's where the will would be lodged. So it's a similar kind of bowing to the primacy of the creature that the pre-mind spirit endowment of the Mother Spirit would allow that being to act first mindily. But that's interesting. So that's the implication that occurs to me.
It's insightful in a way because it helps you understand pre-personal in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you hold them side by side and it's like, okay, it's pure, it's pre, it's pure, it's essential, which would also explain why someone who has pre-mind, has that endowment, would forget, would not have access to their memories, right? Because it's almost like that superseded it. Because mind experiences as well as personality. It's just interesting to think about that. I mean, that never occurred to me before this reading. You know, how so often, you know, those little details like pre-mind. Okay, what the heck? But that actually is insightful when it comes to understanding pre-personal as well. That it's like a pure essence. It's the essence of that Trinity function almost. It's the essence of spirit function, the essence of Father function, the essence of spirit, infinite spirit function.
Yes, that is that function of spirit that occurred before the manifestation of mind.
Right.
That's what the pre refers for me as.
Mm-hmm.
Like pre-personal means, a pre-personal fragment of the Father means it's an essence of the Father that has potentials for personality, but is of the nature of the Father before personality manifests.
Or manifested,
manifested, and the same would be true of a fragment, a pre-mind fragment of the spirit, is that it's a spirit fragment that is of by nature preliminary or antecedent to before the functioning of mind, which means it's able to fit like a puzzle piece with a minded creature without interfering with that creature's mind function. Those are all connotations for me that flow from that pre-mind term.
It also adds insight to the fact that it happens when they resurrect. It's a determination that's made right then. And you get the sense, okay, the determination is made right now. It's irreversible. You know, it's either this or non-survival. Would you say that?
Question you have to ask is there a possibility for a spirit fuser to decline survival as well? That's another issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not the same as a thought adjuster coming and a thought adjuster leaving. But is it possible for a spirit fuser to choose again, since they almost certainly have not made an irrevocable choice for perfection or for doing
not
the Father's
in one
will?
Life.
Not in one life.
Not in one primitive life, say, or
that raises that question.
Wow.
But the idea of pre as preliminary, you know, you can think of it also as just preliminary to mind itself, that without that spirit, there is no mind possible on the Marantia level, is really what that would be indicate for a mortal. There are all kinds of other ways that the spirit can bestow mind, you know, on angels, on all these other kinds of beings, minds of various, you know, breadths and depths and height. But here, for mortals, it has to sit on something, and it has to have something that is dynamically activating it. We know that the thought adjuster, for us, comes with a memory and is, you know, also a pre-energy and therefore pre-mind kind of spirit. They don't emphasize pre-mind with the thought adjuster because that, in a certain sense, just goes without saying if you're also pre-energy and pre-spirit, because mind came after.
Okay.
You know, so, but they are also pre-mind. They are preliminary to our mind coming into being, our Marantia mind. And without them, we won't have a mind. If we ever decline survival before fusion, they depart. You can imagine when they depart, it's got to be like the air going out of the balloon, you know, for that Maharaja body that's there. All of a sudden, consciousness is gone. You're done. Who knows what that looks like? God help us. We may have to witness that someday. But the point is, the same kind of thing that happens with the thought adjuster coming has to be occurring with that pre-mind spirit being bestowed. That initiates consciousness. That initiates the mind, and therefore, as has been said by everyone, you know, the identity and the newly, the re-functioning of that personality.
So Pam asked on the board, pre as in individualized, pre-individualized, as before individualized? That was Pam's question on the board.
In a certain sense, yeah.
In a certain sense, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, if you don't have mind, you're not individualized.
Good point.
You know,
Well, it will to function through that mind.
Well, no, wait. You know, it's important to distinguish those terms, personalized,
I mean, personality
and individualized.
Factor in all of this as well.
No, 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 just a minute. Just a minute. The individualized can be an animal. An animal can be individualized, okay, even though it can't be personalized. So that's the point of pre-mind, is it's re-individualizing that person. Now, the fact that that Maharaja being had a personality, yes, that then allows for personality to occur. But that's when we're talking individualization, it's a broader category, okay? Mm. Your pet cat and your pet dog are individualized, but they're not personalized.
Huh. In a sense, yeah. But
that makes sense.
Well, not in a sense. They have five adjectives.
Yeah, I know. But they don't have enduring individuality.
No, they don't.
That
endures.
Personality chooses survival, is what I'm trying to say.
Correct.
So these spirits use mortals, when they awaken, they'll have the same personality they had on their initial life, during their initial life. And they point out that it is a father. It is a first source personality.
Yeah.
So that's a factor.
And I'm only being particular about this stuff because it's clear they're trying to educate us about this. It's clear that humanity is confused. It's so confused it doesn't know when human personality begins on this planet. And that has all kinds of implications for all kinds of things. And they're trying to give us a sense so that our culture can mature, which clearly, it is not a mature culture.
Not
and
yet.
In order to do that, we have to really understand something about how we're constituted. And understanding spirit fusers gives us insight into who we are as adjuster fusers. I don't think they're telling us because we're going to run into adjuster fusers here on this world. We are going to run into them in the next life, and I think they want to prepare us for that. But even more so, I think they want to prepare us for who we are and understand as well, not just by what they tell us, but also by how contrastively we're different from these spirit-fused ascenders. How are we as fusers? What makes us different? And this is one big thing. You know, they get this pre-mind spirit that doesn't have, you know, their earlier memories, which is curious. So
but
curious.
They do have a soul. They do have a soul. Though.
Yeah.
Sure
well,
they do.
Well,
and
there's
a certain kind of, I think that's where the recognition memory comes from, is from their soul nature.
They must have a soul, or they wouldn't survive.
Yeah,
right?
They say that. Yeah. They develop. They're the bona fide thought adjusters that indwell them during their first life sees to that.
Right.
And that's how they're able to survive. So that soul nature, that soul identity, whatever, I don't know. And they don't mention if they have guardian seraphims or seraphic guardians that might ascend with them. I don't know if that's come up anywhere, but
my
destiny guardians, and the destiny guardians also keep a record of our life. So that's another that we can draw upon in the next life. So if
they must have had a group guardian.
Well, why not?
My recollection, Chuck, is that in this section where they talk about repersonalization, that they talk about the reconstruction of memory with the help of the angels, the guardian angels. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
So
right.
They must have had guardian angels that have accompanied them and have that memory.
Yeah, group guardians are guardians. And you know, I want to, this brings up something else for me. I've always wondered, they make reference in the book that you have to have lived on the material world until at least the age of 16 to ascend beyond the local universe.
16 is the implication, yeah.
And do you think that is that those children who don't live to be at least that old are spirit, then pretty much spirit fused?
No,
that's not true. Okay.
No, they are re-indwelt by their adjusters. It depends on what planet they're from and what age or whatever. But from our planet, they rise up. Their adjuster reunites with them. They go forward and they ascend all the way to paradise. But they are not mustered into the core of the finality. That's the differentiator.
Okay. All right. That's the differentiator. Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, and I had one other question, you guys, about this section. Now, go ahead, Chuck, before I ask this question, because this one's going to be.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is a quick observation from what we've just been talking about. How, you know, we know that our thought adjuster is pre-personal, but that also means that it seeks personality expression through our personality. So that's what kind of creates this collaboration that we have with the thought adjuster, because the adjuster is seeking expression, but it doesn't have full personality the way we do. So it seeks that expression through our personality, and then we seek, of course, all the gifts that the adjuster has to offer spiritually. And in the case of a pre-mind spirit, I'm wondering if you could draw the same parallel to where these pre-mind spirits are seek mind through the ascender of their indwelling. In other words, the Maranchan mind of the ascender, this pre-mind spirit seeks, you know, it's fusing with that mind, maybe. I'm kind of throwing that out. But that this pre-mind spirit of the mother spirit is, if it's prior to mind, and I guess it would also be prior to personality, but it sounds like there's a kind of synergy there, a dynamic bonding or a dynamic merging of nature that goes on, perhaps, where this
complementary almost, complemental
functions through the mind of the spirit fused ascender. But adds that key piece of spirit identity within that mind. Perhaps something like that.
Well, you know, here they are. They're these high commissioners. And, you know, it's interesting how we've come back to this section and really explored it, because it is an amazing section. And I'm intrigued by the fact that they often are on the worlds, they're race commissioners. That really intrigues me, you know, and I just wonder if you guys have any thoughts as to why that might be so. What would lend them to that? That it says from paragraph 5, the High Commissioners begin their service on the planets as race commissioners. In this capacity, they interpret the viewpoints and portray the needs of the various human races. After long experience in problem solving on the inhabited worlds, these race commissioners are advanced to the higher levels of function. Is that just so they get a very practical, basic experience with a common world problem?
Well, their experience is no less valuable than ours. Okay, we both have grown up with thought adjusters. We arise into the next life, and in our case, we keep growing with a thought adjuster and move toward greater and greater identification with the Father's will for us as embodied, if I can say it that way, and spirited by the thought adjuster. They go forward and learn with their pre-mind spirit to grow to be a more and more perfect ascender here, you know, in the local universe. What is the one thing that both of us have that is of value all the way up? Empathy.
Mm.
The difference is they remain in the local universe, and hence they can repletely learn more and more and more about, for instance, the race that they came from as it is manifested among 3.8 million worlds. We're not going to get to 3.8 million worlds before we leave. We'll be lucky if we get to maybe a few hundred or a few thousand before we leave the local universe. I'd say probably more than that. But the point is, we will not have that kind of replete viewpoint of what a race can be that they are going to be privileged to get by virtue of going through the entire 570-level Marantia ascension, achieve, presumably, spirit status, and then come back and function as race commissioners all the way along.
Wow.
And then eventually perhaps high commissioners or whatever else, or celeste, you know, whatever other kind of destiny is open to them. Think about that. You know, they get that repeatedly over and over. So if I had to say, what is this, the signal kind of value to look at there, I would have to say empathy. They have empathy that develops and develops even more and more and more for all these other beings, and they can represent their race. You know, they use that as a term, but I don't think it's just race. I think it's race. I think it's culture. I think it's, you know, vocation. I think it's all of what they experienced and all of what they afterward can identify with and begin to bring to bear. But love to hear your thoughts on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, paragraph 9 says, whenever fairness and justice require an understanding of how a contemplated policy or procedure would affect the evolutionary races of time, these commissioners are at hand to present their recommendations. They are always present to speak for those who cannot be present to speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So,
in the last line in paragraph 5, they say that race commissioners function in an endless series of planetary crises.
Yes.
And then they say they serve as the articulate expression of whole groups of struggling mortals. So in that context, that could go along with what Andre was saying. In other words, that maybe they sometimes function in relation to other kinds of groupings besides race, with race being kind of the overarching.
It speaks to the basic misunderstandings between the races, too, doesn't it? I mean, in a way. And it's interesting to think that all races are resurrected in their own portion of the resurrection hall, right? So just like the sexes have those basic things that aren't understood throughout time, probably races do, too. In other words, what it's telling me is this is a pretty common place where misunderstanding happens, and where perhaps, mm-hmm. like Andre said, where lack of empathy happens, because there's just no way we could understand what it feels like to be that race if we are of another race. It's just intriguing to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, you
think I
think
again, Andre. Go ahead, Chuck, sorry.
Oh, well, I was just to add to what you're saying. I mean, and think about what they tell us about the early, you know, the early days of the Sankic races and how they literally
mm-hmm.
fought each other
right.
to the death almost, to the point where, you know, green.
To annihilation
orange,
almost.
Are almost missing from the planet. I mean, there's some absorption of those two races. But they were pretty completely wiped out. And then the red race was driven off to its own continent. But, I mean, the things that went on early, I mean, in terms of empathy and, like, being nice or whatever.
Right.
You know, that was not
acceptance.
Part of the racial relations of those early periods, particularly, maybe in some cases. But so, in a way, we're maybe a little more civilized than it used to be back then. But that's
well,
only
definitely.
After, you know. Yeah. So how these race commissioners function in those early periods of evolution on a planet where the different races are actually, you know, fighting each other all the time. Or even within a race. You know, they've said that about the red race. And one of their problems
yeah.
was they lost a lot of their best people through just...
Infighting.
Conflict. Yeah, infighting.
Yeah.
Which is
yeah.
sad to think
internecine
about.
Warfare. Our word
internecine
today
warfare.
Is internecine.
Yeah. Huh. Well, it does speak to the difficulty, I think, and it highlights it. It's no easy thing, and we're challenged by it, and it also speaks to how much effort it probably will take and has taken to even get this far, you know, so... It's a good fight worth keeping on, you know, with all we've got to understand our fellows on this planet, to understand that they are, you know, different. And there's differences mm-hmm. there that, you know, you can't just easily overcome. You have to work at it. You have to work at it. And I guess that's mm-hmm. that's what I get. It takes effort. And these guys are specialists. They're called in. To specialize in that, you know.
They seem to be functioning, though, on the seraphic administrative level. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of
right.
like, I mean, the same questions come up with the seraphim. I mean, how do they actually intervene if intervention is necessary? How do
mm-hmm.
they step in and actually make a difference on the ground? And I don't know. They don't tell us much about that. I mean, they do mention the divine executioners at some point who work with the conciliating commissions.
Yeah.
And they're quasi-material. They can do things on the ground. But just in general, you know, when they say talk about looking out for the welfare and the fairness of treatment of a particular race, how that influence is manifest, I guess, is the question
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering about. I mean, probably through the
yeah.
seraphic agencies, no doubt. And maybe in
mm-hmm.
their own right in some sense also. I don't know. But they mostly function in the courts, though, which is interesting. This is down in paragraph 9. Paragraph 8. It says high commissioners are attached to the... No, sorry, 7. We invariably find these commissioners in all the tribunals of justice, as I was looking for, from the lowest to the highest.
The lowest to the highest.
Not that they participate in the proceedings of justice, but they do act as friends of the court, advising the presiding magistrates respecting the antecedents environment and inherent nature of those concerned in the adjudication.
Huh.
So that's the kind of service you can offer if you have this kind of depth of experience.
Right.
They might not be specialists in the terms of being judges or magistrates, but they can offer
as advisors,
advice as friends of the court because of their depth of experience. But again, how all of that filters down to the mortal level, I'm not quite sure I have a real grasp of that.
No. I want to point out that Pam said something on the board that's really interesting. She said, the oils of reconciliation are operative throughout the ascendant career. Paper 28, Ministering Spirits of the Super Universe, this is from 513 in that paper. Completing the triune staff of attachment to the perfectors of wisdom, are these reflectors of the ideals and status of ethical relationships? Therefore, dot, 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 she skips down, therefore do the perfectors of wisdom make available the wise experience of their order as the, quote, oil of reconciliation for the entire universe. And she adds, reflectors of the ideals of the status of ethical relationships. So, it's interesting how everything ties together. And the value, certainly, of reading the entire book and especially studying it so that you understand how these things tie together and new insights then kind of pop up as we study so many times.
there's this theme of, and it manifests in so many different ways, of the proliferation of differences among us and then the tensions that those differences create. I mean, they speak about that in terms of men and women, they describe it as one of the many forms of antagonistic cooperation. and in many respects, as we stretch across the gap between ourselves and other beings who are very different in nature, and other races, it's like that those differences are put there in order to challenge us and encourage our growth as we reach to bridge across those differences. It just seems to be an ongoing pattern in many, many ways in the creation.
And only love bridges that gap, really.
Mm-hmm.
Only a loving heart and a willingness to love and understand.
Mm-hmm.
Not to just be understood, but to also understand, to approach with love and to let that be the guiding force. That's what bridges the gap. That's what makes it possible, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The attitude of love, a loving attitude, which allows us to be willing to understand those differences. To make every effort to understand them. Well, wow, what a great conversation, guys. We took up the first hour almost talking about the last section, which was great. It was a great conversation. Thank you. I so enjoyed that. I feel like I understand them so much better now than I did before. So shall we read six? Yeah.
Sure.
Marvelous. Thank you. Who would like
to
read 6?
Read.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Where are we? Goodness. Let me just see what is my...
Yeah, Celestial Overseers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Get back to my book here. Yeah. Well, I know why.
I did have one last paragraph, the one in the Personality Survival that talks about the spirit fusers and the reconstruction of memory, if you're interested.
Oh,
it's,
yeah, go ahead, Marvin.
It's 112.6.8. Let's see, 112.6. It's a section on the Garantra self. Persistence of memory is proof of the retention of the identity of original selfhood. It is essential to complete self-consciousness of personality continuity and expansion. They're talking about the reawakening on the mansion walls.
Mm-hmm.
Those mortals who ascend without adjusters are dependent on the instruction of seraphic associates for the reconstruction of human memory. So they do have guardian angels. Otherwise, the Varancha souls of the spirit-fused mortals are not limited. The pattern of memory persists in the soul, but this pattern requires the presence of the former adjuster to become immediately self-realizable as continuing memory. Without the adjuster, it requires considerable time for the mortal survivor to re-explore, meaning the spirit-fused survivor, to re-explore and relearn, to recapture the memory consciousness of the meanings and values of a former existence. So they have a reconstructed memory, the spirit-fused ascenders.
Okay.
Anyways, I thought this really gives some interesting detail in relation to the distinction between ourselves and the spirit-fused mortals.
Yeah.
One more instance of
that's
how we're
illuminating.
Different.
Yeah.
It's really
that.
An interesting paragraph. Yeah. So we can go ahead. Yeah, back to the take
celestial overseer. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Nebenon educational system is jointly administered by the Trinity Teacher Sons and the Melchizedek Teaching Corps. But much of the work designed to affect its maintenance and upbuilding is carried on by the celestial overseers. These beings are a recruited corps embracing all types of individuals connected with the scheme of educating and training the ascending mortals. There are upward of 3 million of them in Nevadon, and they are all volunteers who have qualified by experience to serve as educational advisors to the entire realm. From their headquarters on the Salvington Worlds of the Melchizedeks, these overseers range the local universe as inspectors of the Nebadon school technique designed to affect the mind training and the spirit education of the ascending creatures. This training of mind and education of spirit is carried on from the worlds of origin, of human origin, that is, up through the system mansion worlds and the other spheres of progress associated with Jerusalem on the 70 socializing realms attached to Edentia, and on the 490 spheres of spirit progress encircling Salvington. On the universe headquarters itself are numerous Melchizedek schools, the Colleges of the Universe Sons, the Seraphic Universities, and the Schools of the Teacher Sons and the Union of Days. Every possible provision is made to qualify the various personalities of the universe for advancing service and improving function. The entire universe is one vast school. The methods employed in many of the higher schools are beyond the human concept of the art of teaching truth. But this is the keynote of the whole educational system. Character acquired by enlightened experience.
Wow.
The teachers provide the enlightenment. The universe station and the ascender status afford the opportunity for experience. The wise utilization of these two augments character. Fundamentally, the Nebadon educational system provides for your assignment to a task and then affords you opportunity to receive instruction as to the ideal and divine method of best performing that task. You are given a definite task to perform, and at the same time, you are provided with teachers who are qualified to instruct you in the best method of executing your assignment. The divine plan of education provides for the intimate association of work and instruction. We teach you how best to execute the things we command you to do. The purpose of all this training and experience is to prepare you for admission to the higher and more spiritual training spheres of the super universe. Progress within a given realm is individual, but transition transition from one phase to another is usually by classes. The progression of eternity does not consist solely in spiritual development. Intellectual acquisition is also a part of universal education. The experience of the mind is broadened equally with the expansion of the spiritual horizon. Mind and spirit are afforded like opportunities for training and advancement. But in all this superb training of mind and spirit, you are forever free from the handicaps of mortal flesh. No longer must you constantly referee the conflicting contentions of your divergent spiritual and material natures. At last, you are qualified to enjoy the unified urge of a glorified mind long since divested of primitive animalistic trends towards things material. Before leaving the universe of Nebadon, most Urantia mortals will be afforded opportunity to serve for a longer or shorter time as members of the Nebadon Corps of Celestial Overseers. I'll just make this comment because numbers in the Urantia book always befuddle me. The number of celestial overseers that they are telling us about is extraordinarily small. And if most Urantia mortals will be afforded opportunity to serve for a longer or shorter time as members of the Nebadon Corps of Celestial Overseers, either this corps has just gotten started or it's going to be much, much bigger by the time any of us gets to function in it, if most Urantia mortals, and presumably mortals from all kinds of other spheres, get to participate in that. So there are upward of 3 million of them in Nebadon. That just befuddles me. That's it. Just had to get my numerical frustration out.
So is this place to me speaks to the fact that ever throughout our entire career, we will act as students and teachers. And this is us acting as teachers, right? Is that what they're saying? I mean, because then they go on.
Volunteer.
Yeah. There are upward of 3 million of them.
If we volunteer, I mean, clearly this would indicate an enormous churn rate if it's just 3 million. You're in and you're out, you know, but they say for a longer or shorter time, huh? Mm-hmm. Most Urantia mortals? There's something that doesn't quite add up there.
Well, maybe that pertains to us being from Urantia. I mean, they did qualify it. They didn't say most mortals. They said
no, they
most
didn't.
Urantia.
You're right. You're
mortals.
Right. And that's a very interesting. What does that say? If there is that kind of specificity, what does it say? Does it say our experience here on this world is qualifying us in ways that others are not?
I think so.
To have
I think so.
An extraordinary. Well, maybe.
Even if they didn't say it, I think they say it in many, many ways. I mean, an Agendaunter has to be uniquely qualified to teach things that couldn't be taught by someone who's not an Agendaunter. You know, so
I appreciate that clarification, but boy, 3 million is still a tiny number, even if it's just most Urantia mortals. Because there's 7.9 billion of us now, and even if only a tenth of us went forward, right, that would be 790 million in one generation, or one cohort of a few generations, rather. So, I don't know. It's a lot.
It speaks to how long we might be. Go ahead, Chuck. Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, they say they're a recruited corps. So they probably recruit as many as they need. but not, you know, maybe beyond that. I mean, they say, they describe their work. They say from their headquarters on the Salvington Worlds for the Melchizedeks, these overseers range the local universes and as inspectors of the Nevadon school technique designed to affect the mind training and the spirit education of the ascending mortal, ascending creatures. So they're kind of like inspectors, I guess. They check out all the different Nevadon schools and report back. Still, you'd think they'd need more than a million to carry that on, but it's not like they flood the schools as teachers, from what I'm gathering from this. It's more like they come in temporarily as an inspector and leave. So they could conceivably, one of these could, you know, be traveling about and performing this service in multiple locations from, you know, day to day or whatever. I don't know. I mean, I would assume they're, the number of them has to do with their function. And whatever that function is, apparently, around a million of them is enough to cover it. But
yeah,
I don't know. It is kind of a puzzle. One of the things that really strikes me, though, in this section is the way they talk about this. Like the last line of 37.6.4, where they say, "We teach you how to best execute the things we command you to do." And says you're given a definite
you gotta do it.
Form.
You got to do it.
At the same time,
you
you're provided with teaching. So, but my thought about that is that coming from this planet where we don't have celestial overseers, so to speak, you know, like a material son and daughter, even a planetary prince, this is like a totally a DIY planet. You know, we have to make our own plans. We have to figure out our own assignments. We have to teach ourselves how to do the things we need to do in order to execute the things that we command ourselves to do, right? So
get with the universe program. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, this is life on a rebellion planet, which requires extreme adaptation on the part of the individual to self-direct.
Right.
And that may not be true on normal worlds. On normal worlds, it has the typical, you know, the regimes of the planetary
I think it would not be true on normal worlds. I agree. It would not be
true. I think things are probably way more organized. And you have superhuman presence visible on the planet who's helping to coach that organization of human affairs. So the thing that always hits me when I read a paragraph like that is, wow, is it going to be boring? You know, and not to say that it will be, but it also makes me wonder if maybe we'll be able to, you know, they say the Agon Donners are sort of cordoned off by themselves and they're given special kinds of assignments. So maybe that having come from a background where we've been so intensely driven into self-direction, not in the Luciferian sense, but just out of necessity, right? That we may be able to serve in a kind of a special way, or maybe there'll be something a little different about our educational development there.
Yeah,
idea of being told what to do, I just kind of, part of me just kind of like, ew, I don't know. I don't know. I just think about being commanded what to do and all that.
Well, this is being from a planet
in
rebellion, certainly.
And great, but it makes you feel like a rebel.
I have a feeling we will have fallen in line by the fourth or fifth mansion world.
The fourth or fifth.
Well,
we'll understand they're benign, you know, at some point,
sure,
and that
they
mean the best for us. But wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. We're ultra individualistic, a lot of us here, and it's going to be an adjustment, you know, getting used to that kind of order.
At the same time, several places in the book, they really, really come, you know, really uphold initiative, individual initiative and originality. And in Jesus' teachings, it was the same thing. The combination of originality and initiative, or even characterize the rulings of the ancients of days, they say. So that's also high priority, and we're getting a lot of training in that by necessity. So that's going to happen.
And they learn a lot from us.
To play.
Just like we learn from our children, they learn a lot from us, you know, obviously. In their observation, they're learning a lot by just observing this planet in rebellion, as well as all other planets. I'm sure they learn unique things. But planets who are fairly ordered in this universal sense don't offer as much information to them as we do. We're, you know, we're a study for them. They're probably fascinated by us, you know. But what intrigues me about this section is that they're telling us what education is in Nevadon. You know, the keynote of the whole educational system. I mean, it's like, heads up, here it is, kids, the keynote of the whole educational system. Character acquired by enlightened experience. That's amazing to me. That's the keynote of the entire educational system in this universe. Character acquired by enlightened experience. The teachers provide the enlightenment, the universe station, and the ascender status afford the opportunity for experience. The wise utilization of these two augments character. What a formula. I can't help but think, what could we do to our educational systems to mimic this more? You know, this is clearly learned by doing. That's what experience is, right? But to teach character based on that. And then they go on to say, fundamentally, the Nevadon educational system provides for your assignment to a task and then affords you the opportunity to receive instruction as to the ideal and divine method of performing that task. How wonderful would that be? You said, Chuck, we're on the DIY planet. We don't know. Half the time we're guessing what would be the best way to achieve our goal. And we do value education because it does give us that. Absolutely.
And there's a kind of character development that comes from that isn't probably going to, I mean, they talk about character development, but if you're told what to do and how to do it all the time, then you're just kind of going through the motions. I mean, not really, but I mean, it could sound that way, as opposed to, you know, trying and failing and picking yourself up again and trying something else and failing again and then trying again, you know, where you learn so much through that process of even repeated failure if you continue on with your determination and the kind of strength of character. And, you know, so many places in the book they talk about that, you know, the hammer and anvil and all of that, forging out, you know, tempered steel of true character and all of that. And that's, to me, that sounds like, you know, tough conditions. So maybe some of these assignments, even that they're talking about here, are not like sitting at your desk and doing homework. You know, there's maybe something to be done somewhere, and you're assigned to help out. You know, sort of like working on a construction crew or something. I mean, not literally, but you know what I mean? Joining a team is trying to solve some kind of difficult problem that's going on. And then you can, you know, learn and play a role in that somehow. I mean, somehow through all of this, those values of originality and initiative have to be developed, because that's really, to me, that's a sign of character. I mean, that's, you know, that's how character grows. So it's somehow there's emerging of these different priorities, program you're talking about, no doubt. But for mortals coming from a normal world, where everything has been kind of more like this, you know, more organized, then they would probably be less able to cope with situations that do require a lot of initiative and thinking on your feet and stuff like that. I don't know.
Here's another a cross-reference, another hint from the Midwayers. This is from paper 195, which I know we all know and love well. The Midwayers on 1017 tell us even secular education could help in this great spiritual renaissance if it would pay more attention to the work of teaching youth how to engage in life planning and character progression. The purpose of all education should be to foster and further the supreme purpose of life, the development of a majestic and well-balanced personality. There is a great need for the teaching of moral discipline in the place of so much self-gratification. Upon such a foundation, religion may contribute its spiritual incentive to the enlargement and enrichment of mortal life, even to the security and enhancement of eternal life. So that they're saying it again in a different way. And, you know, I just think this is a place where education is lacking on our world, you know. So much of the purpose of education is to have a better material life. But it doesn't really help young people have a better spiritual life, you know, engage in life planning and character progression, which would clearly be, you know, unselfishness, altruism, loyalty, honesty, integrity, you know. That's interesting to me.
The paragraph 6, I think, is really interesting in terms of what you're saying and how this is approached, you know, where they point out that the progression of eternity does not consist solely in spiritual development. Intellectual acquisition is also a part of universal education. The experience of the mind is broadened equally with the expansion of the spiritual horizon. Mind and spirit are afforded like opportunities for training and advancement. So this is, and then they go on to say how we're forever free from the handicaps of the mortal flesh, right? So we can just focus on mind and spirit primarily. But that could begin here, is what kind of thing what you're suggesting, Paula, is a recognition. Yeah, you have to train your mind, and you also have to train yourself spiritually. And that's a real thing.
Yeah.
That's not just some ephemeral whatever. You know?
Mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, and that's in fact, that's what gets us off the planet. So if you haven't done that, you're going to have a hard time, you know, surviving into the next life.
I can't help but think, you know, education goes on from the cradle to the grave, right? And these are things that, you know, we could start to incorporate in our teaching conduct when we.
Yeah, things can be done deliberately with purpose. Recognizing that spiritual training is a part of character development, which should be part of education, and to somehow incorporate those values consciously and deliberately, you know, make a decision on some level where it's like, yeah, we recognize this is important, so we're going to try and include this in some way.
Yeah. I'm curious, Marvin and Andre, you're going to have your UUI, Urantia University Institute board meeting next weekend. Did this strike you as being like, wow?
We look at and quote some of the passages in this section often. And you know, a few different things jump out at me in this section. If you don't mind, I'll sort of pick them out and just comment.
Sure.
The first one is in the second paragraph where they say this training of mind and education of spirit, and the implication is that these celestial overseers are active at these levels, is carried on from the worlds of human origin up through the system mansion worlds. So what's interesting to me is, I mean, the implication for me is that on a normal world where you've got a planetary prince headquarters and an atom and, you know, a Garden of Eden and a Damic headquarters, both of which have educational efforts as part of them, right? They've got schools, both of those. And as the eras unfold on a normal world, there are other revelatory impacts and beings, and that some of this function is actually part of a normal evolutionary world's function. Down here, I think we have it hardly at all because of the disruption of the rebellion. We don't have those planetary centers. But yeah. So that's one thought, is that the work of the celestial overseers actually happens on the evolutionary worlds, and we get our first exposure to how they function and exactly this kind of educational regime, you know, is actually happening on the inhabited worlds. That's where we get our first exposure, and how bereft we are that our educational institutions don't have the benefit of these higher celestial ministries, educational ministries, to help us structure how we engage in our education. So that caught me. The other thing that caught me is whenever they use the word character or character development, I always associated with soul and soul development and soul growth. Those to me, they're not synonymous, but they're correlated realities. I think character and soul, and one of the things they say is that kind of development is based, that the fundamental unit of it is living experience. And that's what struck me about this whole section, is that the educational system is not simply about cognitive understanding. And this is sprinkled throughout the Urantia book. It's about personal transformation and growth, right? It's about character growth, character emergence, soul emergence. It's about changing our basic nature and how we act. Not just what we understand, but how we act, and how what we understand informs how we act. But it's not simply enough to understand something. The implication is they put us in situations where they give us understanding, they give us tasks to complete. We engage in those tasks, service tasks, teaching tasks, whatever, and those experiences that we go through, applying the knowledge, change us and develop our character. So that's thrilling, really. That and you know, we've got this amazing teacher inside of us, the thought adjuster, that's and Michael's spirit of truth, whispering truth. So we've got all kinds of aids that are helping us in that transformative process. And the purpose of education is transformation, is change of our very nature. And that's how we advance. So it's very interesting to me that they put us in situations where we don't just, it's not like our universities, our schools, where you're expected to imbibe a certain amount of knowledge, and then the end result is you spit that knowledge back out in a test, and then, you know, you get checked off, you get a grade, and you're done. It's in our schools, we think of it as the development of an informational base. And they're saying, no, that's just one part of it. The other part of it is, the other parts are the application of that information in living experience and in service and in activities and functions, so that you're changed and you grow, which is really interesting, that's the object of the education. And they help us do that. You know, at every step along the way, they've got coaching and they've got beings who know how to do this. But they are saying, you have to learn how to do this, guys, you know, and that's what we're here to help you with. So that's what struck me, is the difference between cognition or understanding and experience and transformation is the purpose of the educational regimen. And the last thing that struck me was, it's the second to last paragraph, But in the middle of the paragraph, second line, 37.66, but in all this superb training of mind and spirit, you are forever free from the handicaps of mortal flesh. No longer must you constantly referee the conflicting contentions of your divergent spiritual and material natures. At last, you are qualified to enjoy the unified urge of a glorified mind long since divested of primitive animalistic trends towards things material. And I'm curious, I'd love to get your guys' thoughts on the implications of this last two sentences in that paragraph. We don't have to struggle with those things. We're no longer constantly refereeing these conflicting contentions of divergent spiritual material natures. To me, there's two huge pieces of good news in this section. One is that the environment we're in is so well ordered and designed to really teach us and go. It's so orderly and so superb in the nature of its organization, in contrast to the cultures that we grow up in on this world, which are so confused and chaotic and misprioritized in so many ways. So that's a huge advantage, I think, that it's orderly and makes sense and is structured well by design. And they say at the beginning of this section, this caught me as well, the very first sentence, but much of the work designed to affect its maintenance and upbuilding, meaning the educational system, is carried on by the celestial overseers. So there's profound design in how these things are structured, and it's the celestial overseers that are doing a lot of that structuring and designing it. So that's interesting. We'll get a chance to participate in that. But the other thing that to me is just really good news is we won't have to struggle with the limitations of our material natures, you know, which are very erratic and undependable in many ways. We have to fight them or compensate for them and in so many ways. I'm
think
curious,
what a struggle that is.
What a
struggle.
What do you think the differences are? Yeah.
Go ahead,
yeah.
Chuck.
Yeah. Well,
go ahead, Chuck.
It's a couple things. I mean, during this life, it's that contrast, even though it's a struggle that we have to referee, we come to value this as we grow and develop character, if we do, by contrast with our material nature, you know, and we try to bring them into harmony. But the fact that our material nature is always competing for attention almost compels us to deliberately seek out and try to find the spiritual dimension as well. So when that works out the way it's supposed to, I think that's part of what propels us into a spiritual life are these contentions. So it's hard here, but it's part of what trains us, I think, to appreciate maybe the way it's going to be later. But what really struck me in that last sentence, they talk about the unified urge. Recently when I was reading through the Adjutant Mind description of the Adjutant Mind spirits, they're also all described as an urge. Five out of seven use that term specifically, and the first two they use other language, but it kind of has the same meaning. So the Adjutant spirits, in terms of their functional importance, provide what they offer as an urge. You know, the urge to acquire knowledge, or the urge to worship, or the urge for wisdom. So we have these like seven different urges, you might say, functioning within us with Adjutant Mind, and that's closely tied to our material nature. So that's part of what's going on there. So when they talk about having a unified urge, that's that's going to lift off of our material nature. You know, that's going to be probably a characteristic of Mirage Mind. Which is a higher type of mind bestowal that's prepared for us by the Mother Spirit. But I like that thought of having a unified urge, because we have a lot of competing urges as it is, and they're all important, you know, and we have to unify them ourselves, you know, through our evolved understanding and acquirement of character and determination and spiritual awareness and relationship with God and all of that. I mean, probably our relationship with God is what really unifies our multiple urges during this life. You know, if you put all of that focused into that relationship, that's a highly unifying influence in our lives, of course. And we all seek that and work with that and look for that and try and manifest it to an ever greater degree. But when we graduate to a higher type of mind, then all those urges are somehow going to become one urge, which is going to be this, I don't know, sounds like a powerful urge of ascension. It might be one way of putting
spiritual
it.
Spiritual urge. Yeah.
Yeah, the glorified
mind. Well, and the way they describe that urge, they say the unified urge, then they qualify it of a glorified mind. I mean, think
right.
about that. I'm looking forward to a glorified mind. a mind that is really well developed and really suffused with spiritual values. A glorified mind, I love this, long since divested of primitive animalistic trends toward things material. And then associated with that is no longer must you constantly referee the conflicting contentions of your divergent spiritual and material natures. So, you know, we're engaged here in this world, and for us it's ordinary, but it's not ordinary in many, many ways, and we will be free of it at these higher stages of this. Really, it's a conflictual situation of material needs, material forces and actions on our very nature for processing reality, the way we think, the way we feel, the way we, you know, how we try to find our way to spiritual truth, beauty, and goodness is very attenuated and affected by our material natures, especially on a world where our material natures themselves have been negatively impacted by the lack of, you know, good genetic base because of the Adamic default. So, you know, we're just dealing with stuff here that we take as ordinary, that I don't even think we think about. It's just like, this is what we got to deal with. And for me, it's such good news when they say long since divested of these mm-hmm. conflicts and these trends, we will have much, much better equipment to work with, is my end takeaway. And I can't even anticipate the nature of how different in a good way that will be. But it's good news to me that it will be the case. They're promising us that.
And you know, with what they've... Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Marvin, finish your thought.
No, that was it, yeah.
Well, with what they've told us in prior papers and the natural evolution of the human species and on normal worlds, the whole effort is to get to that place on a material world as well, to get to where all of these, you know, these strivings, these urges to maintain a material life aren't so acute. And they're very acute for us. I mean, let's face it, what do your parents do? Your parents do everything they can to make sure you survive, right, from the very beginning, with the food you need, the water you need, the clothing you need, the roof over your head you need, and good families provide that for their children so that their children don't have to worry so much about those things. But inevitably, then, you know, you have to go out into the world yourself and make sure you provide for all of your own needs, as well as if you want to have children, you provide for their needs. And on this world, that's no easy thing. We see it over and over and over again. So no wonder our thrust still is to provide material needs, because it's just so apparent that it takes up most of our effort.
It's essential. It's essential.
It's essential. It's basic. If we could master that, then, you know, as the book tells us in so many other places, we would be free to pursue more lofty spiritual goals, you know, and philosophy and art and music, and these things would flower because we're no longer weighed down with this, the heaviness of trying to meet our material needs. And you pointed out a big one. Yeah, you pointed out a big one, Marvin, and that is just, let's just look at pain management. right? You talk about disease that causes pain. And how many humans are just racked with that? You know, how can you divest yourself of your body when it's in pain so much of the time? And, you know, I know you guys aren't in constant pain, but we all know somebody that is. And we all know that how much effort that takes on their part to try to manage that and how distracting and traumatizing that is. You know, so to your point, Marvin, I mean, our whole human goal should be to achieve, you know, we should all be focused on that achievement of mastering these material needs, to creating the civilization, mastering the elements, you know, providing for basic needs so that we can pursue spiritual, intellectual, philosophical pursuits, you know, artistic pursuits.
One thing briefly.
Well, go for it.
Yeah, I wasn't participating earlier in the show too much, and that's because I was dealing with some physical things that I needed to take care of. I wanted to be participating, and I couldn't, and not with any quality either. And you're mentioning pain, things that just relate to our bodies and bodies that don't work particularly well. And it's a constant wrestling match. And I found this paragraph I was looking while you were sharing, Paula. And for me, it's so relevant. It's in the section on the spirit and the flesh. It's 34:7-3. And they say, the mortals of a normal world, and we are not on a normal world, do not experience constant warfare between their physical and spiritual natures. Mm. That's crazy, man. Constant warfare between our physical and spiritual natures. They were confronted with a necessity of climbing up from the animal levels of existence to the higher planes of spiritual living. And this connects up with what we've been reading. It's not just about understanding something. It's about higher planes of spiritual living, service, relationship, activities. You know, it's the whole regimen within which we function and live. They're confronted with the necessity of climbing up from the animal levels of existence to the higher planes of spiritual living, but this ascent is more like undergoing an educational training when compared with the intense conflicts of Urantia mortals in this realm of the divergent material and spiritual natures. So even on the evolutionary worlds, a normal world, these things are much less intense. Here on this world, the difference, the divergent material and spiritual natures lead to intense conflicts. So what it says
intense.
Is very intense, and there's a discrepancy between this world and a normal world, and then there's this discrepancy, as we were reading, between this stage of existence and these higher stages, where we're long since divested of that struggle, and the urges are unified, nothing really stands in their way, and we're so much better equipped to accomplish this. That's very encouraging, I think.
Mm-hmm. You know? Extremely so.
Yeah.
Extremely.
Interesting.
Encouraging.
Interesting overview of this whole process in paper 48 I just came across. They're talking about the mansion world teachers in this particular section, but this is where they're describing something about the educational regime on the mansion worlds, and then go on from there. They say, in the schools of the Urantia life, these teachers, meaning the mansion world teachers, engage in individual group, class, and mass teaching. On the mansion world, such schools are organized in three general groups of 100 divisions each, the schools of thinking, the schools of feeling, and the schools of doing. When you reach the constellation, there are added the schools of ethics, the schools of administration, and the schools of social adjustment. On the universe headquarters worlds, you will enter the schools of philosophy, divinity, and pure spirituality.
Wow.
So you can see there's an interesting progression going on there where it becomes less and less tied back to our memories, perhaps, of our physical experience. It's like starting out on the mansion world, you know, they say we pick up where we left off. So this idea of having the schools organized according to thinking, feeling, and doing, I think is really interesting, because it's in the doing that maybe some of the things you're talking about, Marvin, you know, in terms of character growth and development and our relationship, you know, our ability to form relationships and that sort of thing, will all be wrapped up in that, because it requires thought and feeling and doing to accomplish mm-hmm. those things. And they mm-hmm. make an interesting comment about Dalmatia, actually, where they say that SAD sponsored the Dalmatia plan of teaching that was carried out as an industrial school in which the pupils learned by doing, and through which they worked their way by the daily performance tasks. But then they point out that the plan of education did not ignore thinking and feeling in the development of character, but it gave first place to manual training, you know, something practical. So
well, right, it's
like
that material maintenance.
That carries over in some sense to at least our early days on the mansion worlds. It's also going to be organized along these same lines.
If the mansion worlds are remedial training, then really, honestly, this thinking, feeling, and doing, what these schools are doing on the mansion worlds, could and probably are done on a normal world. You've got that before you ever go
yeah,
up there.
Well, they say Dalmatia was, the schools were organized along those lines.
Yeah,
so
right.
You get the sense that there would be a matching up then. You know, an ascender coming from a normal world would have already been prepared by the educational regime of his native planet to just sort of like go right on into the same kind of educational, the same organizational approach to education that exists on the mansion world. And I just can't resist throwing in a third parallel, which is the Sethite priesthood, if you all recall, that they say that was a threefold undertaking, embracing religion, health, and education.
Huh.
So there again, that's kind of a similar pattern. Not exactly, but kind of. I mean, if you think of religion more like feeling and education more like thinking and health more like doing, I don't know.
One thought in relation to the term feeling, the Urantia book contextualizes the use of that word in some very interesting ways. And for me, the most helpful one is it's in the section on, I think it's on personality survival, where they talk about feeling values. That which feels values is the combined creation of the mind and the thought addresser, which is the soul. So it's the soul is the part of us that senses and processes spiritual values like truth, beauty, goodness, honor, loyalty, service. You know, those are all, they'll have value components. And so when they say thinking, I associate that with understanding and factual information. And the realm of meanings, right? And when I think feeling and the schools of thinking, feeling, and doing, the feeling component is mining our experience, really processing our experience and our social relations, our relationship experiences for ethical and morality values that our souls experience, and we experience soul growth. So for me, the realm of feeling is the realm of relationship and character and soul growth, and doing would be service activities, and you know, all these things are married up. I mean, when you're doing something, you're often in relationship with other people, and there are value realities being lived out, and you're using knowledge, mind knowledge, and information as well. So it's like it's a unified thing, but it's interesting that they focus in those three different ways and use those terms, thinking, feeling, and doing.
Andre mentioned empathy earlier, and you don't do empathy.
Mm-hmm.
You feel it. you know?
You can
see how.
It.
Right, yeah. right.
Right.
You experience it and feel it.
Marvin, I think maybe you're referring to.
There's no experiencing of a value unless it's lived out in a set of interactions, and usually in relationship with other beings. It's a socially experienced phenomenon. Values are, I think,
Like they're put into practice.
Relationships.
Yeah, here's this short quote. Maybe it's the one you're thinking of. I don't know, but they say that mind knows quantity, reality, and meanings, but quality, values, is felt. That which feels is the mutual creation of mind, which knows, and the associated spirit, which realityizes. You gotta love that. That's only in the Rancher book. Something like that.
A coined term.
Realityizing. But anyway, I think that's so interesting, though, that the associated spirit, you know, meaning this thought adjuster, part of what it does is realityize.
It makes it real, in other words.
Right.
It makes it real for you. Right.
Right. And that combination of the recognition of reality and meanings and quantity by the mind, combined with this realityizing influence of the spirit, is what enables us to feel values.
Right.
And that's how we recognize values. We feel. We feel beauty. We feel goodness. We feel truth. They have a feeling associated with those, you know, characteristics of divinity that we come to recognize by how they feel. And that feeling is somehow tied to the first source and center. I mean, it gives us a directional sense in reality. You know, there are absolute values that provide direction for our own personal growth and evolution and progress of the universe and everything within it. And that's, you know, that's such an important realization, I think, and it's often missing in the culture, is that sense of a unified, you know, it's almost like a preview of the unified urge, you know, is this realization that there's this goal that's represented by, you know, original deity, which is what unifies the universe. So being able to participate in that, join up.
Isn't that interesting, too, that what we all really want is to feel love, to feel understanding, to feel joy,
love.
To feel peace, to feel compassion, to feel empathy. You know, we want it to know it by having it bestowed on us, but also to be able to give it to others then so that they feel it too. We really want to share those divine values with each other. It's what we love the most. It's what we crave the most. You know, and yet we often choose substitutes for those things that kind of deaden that desire instead of trying to create that which we most want, you know, by giving it. You know, we most want compassion. We must give it. We most want love, but we must give it to realize it. And we must give it to others so that they feel it and they reciprocate that. You know, it's interesting. It's all based on what we crave to feel from each other, what we really in our soul are craving, those divine values. And I wanted to share one quote, because we were talking about the physical urges and appetites, essentially, in this section. And this is from one of the great decisions that Jesus made, and it's in paper 36:6-10. And it says, this great decision of Jesus portrays dramatically the truth that selfish satisfaction and sensuous gratification alone and of themselves are not able to confer happiness upon evolving human beings. There are higher values in mortal existence, intellectual mastery and spiritual achievement, which far transcend the necessary gratification of man's purely physical appetites and urges. Man's natural endowment of talent and ability should be chiefly devoted to the development and ennoblement of his higher powers of mind and spirit. So again, you know, the same theme is reiterated. What they're trying to teach mm-hmm. us, as Andre keeps saying, they're trying to educate us here, folks. And it's mm-hmm. true, they are. This is what they're doing. They're showing us what really matters and illuminating a path forward to that, what really mm-hmm. matters to us, not our appetites and urges, so much more.
Well, and what, you know, when Jesus was asked, and, you know, you return to the essentials of the gospel, when Jesus was asked, you know, what is the most important thing? What's the priority in life? He said, love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. You know, do that, and everything else will be delivered. You know, so, and those are experiential, profound experiential and feeling relational realities. They're all about the relationship of love and in action. And that's mm-hmm. not at all to minimize the mind or the physical doing of things. It's all part and parcel of it.
Right.
You know,
unified.
Wise love. Yeah, wise love is, they speak a lot about wise love and unwise love.
Right.
You know, so it's like
right.
that's all informative. And you know, one of my takeaways from all of that we've been reading is that in this life, we are encouraged to be engaged in these endeavors, to pursue them, these highest priorities of living, doing, and feeling, mm-hmm. spiritual valuing. And we are confronted with constant mitigating factors that relate to our material nature and our rebellion sphere status, illness, pain, the physical gravity of aging. You know, the slow deterioration of our mechanisms of body and mind, you know,
yep.
and short lifespans, all these things which are part of the degraded material nature of our particular sphere, and the conflicting
yeah.
philosophies that confuse and cause chaos and violence and, you know, short lives and war, et cetera, all that stuff. So all that stuff to me is lumped in when they say the constant warfare of our material nature
yeah.
on a rebellion sphere. And yet, what the Master is telling us is fight the good fight of faith. Do your best.
Right.
You know?
Reach
for the spiritual ideas.
Yeah.
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 Love.
It was interesting, though, in that what you read there, Paul, just to squeeze this in the last minute, where they say, higher values in mortal existence, but then they say, which far transcend the necessary gratification of man's
yeah.
purely physical appetites and
right.
urges.
Right.
So
it's necessary. And that's the warfare
that.
Right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
True. So if we try to suppress
that's what we have
that
to master
arbitrarily too much, then that we get distorted. You know,
right.
there has to be some kind of a balance, you know, it's like
we have,
you know,
to embrace it and accept it and master
right.
it.
Right. Master
yeah.
it.
That's the goal.
Right. But there's a recognition even on the part of this author that the gratifications of our purely physical appetites and urges is a necessary part of our
yeah.
life.
Right.
So,
and necessary,
you know,
to our own growth. Obviously.
And, you know, procreation, too, you know, so you can
right.
throw that in.
Exactly.
You know,
that yeah,
only
throw that
because
in.
Of this, the powerful urge to do that, you know, everything
yeah.
involved in that.
Like Jesus told Gannett, God put them there for a reason, right? But
yeah, right,
people
exactly.
get confused
so
about them.
We should have kind of
and that's beginning. All, folks.
Sure.
That was a great conversation,
right.
I got to say. Thank you, guys. It was wonderful. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thanks to all of our listeners. You guys on the board loved your comments today. Isadora, I'm going to look into the Steiner School. That was new to me. So love you guys so much. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back next
right.
week, maybe.
Yeah,
hopefully.
Fun.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll be
all
in touch.
Right.
Sure enough.
Thanks, Jeff.
Marvin and
thanks,
I'll
Marvin.
See you in
thanks,
2 weeks.
Andre.
Yeah.
Thanks,
yep. Paula, Andre.
Marvin, I'll see you in a
great
few days.
That's right.
All right. Love you all.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Love you guys.
Okay.
We love you.
All the best. Bye-bye.
All the best. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.